This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. A tax cut is coming. We just don't know yet how much of a tax cut and how the state of Ohio will pay for it. Voting hours are set. 29 days of early voting. Everyone can vote by mail. In-person voting hours, which were cut, is causing controversy. Columbus has made its pitches to the Republican and Democratic parties for the 2016 National Convention. Now it needs to close the sale. And those are the stories in the news this week. For the next hour, we will dig deeper on those stories and more with a panel of reporters. Jackie Borchard from the Northeast Ohio Media Group. Her State House reporting appears in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Welcome, Jackie.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Darryl Rowland, Public Affairs Editor for the Columbus Dispatch, is joining us here Monday morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And Julie Carr Smythe, State House Correspondent with the Associated Press. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Darryl, as a former TV reporter who often stood on a street corner in slushy, shoelace-deep snow after predictions of a foot or more, it could have been a lot worse. No person was probably glad to see this storm pass us by than Mayor Mike Coleman after the experience he's had this winter.
Certainly. Snow removal historically over the last 20, 30 years has caused lots of political problems for lots of mayors across the country, from Denver to wherever. And when the last one went through and you have your citizens on some of those residential streets saying the city's snow removal plan is spring, that's not exactly the feather in the cap.
But the roads were pretty clear today, it seemed, anyway, on my way in.
Right, not too bad. I think some of the private roads and the plowing that has to take place on these side areas is still presenting a problem, though. I've seen a few of those areas around.
But they seem to have more plows on the street, at least according to the news releases, than they had in the previous storm. So it seems like the complaints and the coverage that the last couple storms have gotten got the city's attention, so they weren't going to take any chances this time around.
I hope so, because the last storm, my neighborhood wasn't plowed for a week. And by that point, you know, when the plows came through, it only took off maybe the top inch, leaving a ice skating rink underneath, and underneath that, about a bajillion potholes. So yeah.
That's the next crisis, the pothole crisis.
Right.
You're already seeing them pop up around town. So, of course, the snow was worse, you know, south of Columbus. I think Chillicothe and Point South did get a lot of snow, and there were school cancellations. Julie, what is the status of the Calamity Day controversy at the State House? The schools have pretty much used up all of their, quote, snow days because of the nasty weather, and the legislature is trying to help them out by relieving them of the state law, which requires them to go to school a certain number of days. So what's the status of that leniency?
Right. The Senate passed a different version of that bill last week. They had some concerns about just providing open-ended days. And so they also were concerned about the cost that might entail. And so they passed sort of a compromise bill. And maybe Jackie remembers exactly some of those provisions.
It's a moving target.
Right, it is. And the House passed a bill a couple weeks ago. And in their version, they wanted to give two more calamity days, which are days that are just waived that the schools wouldn't have to make up, and then give them two more professional development days. So those are days where students wouldn't have to be there, but teachers would still report to work for something. And then what the Senate did with that bill is they added in a provision that said, you know, we'll give you more calamity days, but first you have to make up four of the five scheduled snow makeup days that are already built into your calendars. And the issue with that, though, is so every school district is supposed to pencil in 5 days where they can make up school for whatever reason they've had to cancel it. And a lot of schools will schedule those days in June, you know, at the end of the year or during a holiday. And as we've heard in the House debate, that can be problematic. You can't just switch on a day that you were scheduled off. You have to pay for support staff, for your custodians, people who in their contracts are on a holiday. So you're paying holiday pay to make up a day. So what the Senate did is they said, look, you got to make up four of those 5 days. And then when you've exhausted those, so we're at nine days, then you can have an extra, they gave three calamity days and one professional development day.
Right, and we've seen it. Our in my daughter's district, for example, they've already then announced, you know, these 2 days that were scheduled off in the spring mm-hmm. now aren't going to be off because they're trying to make those up before June. I feel like maybe something happens in June where it goes into some sort of summer hours or pay scale mm-hmm. that everybody's seeming to want to avoid this year.
Daryl, lost in all this, it seems, to talk about, you know, whether teachers should get days off, whether it should be holiday pay for custodians, whether their vacation plans are disrupted. Lost in all this is the kids are missing school days. And the whole point of having a certain number of days during the year to educate children sort of gets tucked behind it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, Mike, when you and I were young, we were concerned about that when we were going
it
to school, right?
It snowed every day. And we made it.
That's right.
Uphill,
and,
both directions. Right. 10 miles.
That's right. We were totally devoted to our classwork. So, yeah, it is interesting how the conversation, a lot of it's been how much do we whack teachers? You know, we can't just give them the freebie of the days off or whatever. You know, and the longer this goes on, for heaven's sakes, it's a bill about calamity days. It's now gone to a conference committee in the legislature.
Over one day.
It's like, good grief. And ironically, the longer that the legislature dallies, some of these contingency days are going into the rearview mirror. For instance, if, you know, President's Day was one of those days for some districts, well, that has come and gone.
Yeah, spring break is right around the corner.
Yeah,
right.
And you know, lots of families already have plans, maybe booking things, you can't get the money back or what have you. So, you know, it's not bad enough that the winter is bad. The legislature has to step in and see if they can make things worse.
And ironically enough, you know, the weather was so bad they couldn't come to Columbus a couple of times and meet on this. So. Not on this particular
now,
bill, but they did
make
cancel
those days
some.
Up? Do they have to make those days up?
Well, I actually had an email, and I don't know if it's from a teacher or not, saying, well, yeah, what about when the legislature cancels? Or certainly they are not meeting 5 days a week, not even close lately. It's been basically a 2-day-a-week schedule as far as business in Columbus. Yeah, they get paid all the time, no matter what.
Now, I think the lawmakers are grading bills and you know, making up lists on their days off, correct, like teachers are when they're off time?
And buying supplies for their constituents, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, the other thing is when you cancel the schools for a day, sure, the day is not that time is gone, but then that's extra time that's being spent in the classroom to catch the students up, mm-hmm. especially with the spring state test looming. You know, they still have to hit certain benchmarks and certain, you know, get things done. So now they're you know, a couple lessons behind and working extra hard to catch up the students. So it's you know, you can't really say that there's no work that's being done.
Right. And I think also that we're in a period of time where we're asking a lot of homework on an average week. You know, a lot of work gets brought home by kids all the way from elementary school up. And so having these blizzard bags, which is this option that they're providing for making up for the student end of it, you know, it's an added time commitment for the kids. And, you know, that's
But that actually
tricky.
Makes sense. I mean, you see that there's, I mean, we knew Friday there was a chance of a snow day on Monday. It didn't work out that way. But, you know, you could say, look, if we have a snow day on Monday, do this. I mean, and Daryl, you said you've written and you mentioned on TV that this will all be moot next year because the law changes, the Calamity Day law.
Right. And just generally speaking, they're going to a system where it's minimum hours instead of minimum days. That is much more lenient. However, now it has dawned on the legislature what they actually did a couple of years ago. So now they're taking a look at maybe they've gotten a little too lenient on all the kiddies and the teachers in Ohio. And you know, everyone is right. You know, at the same time, they are attempting to ratchet up accountability with the third grade reading guarantees, you know, graduation tests, you know, lots of testing. In theory, you need, you know, some instruction time to prepare for that testing. The state is allowing a lot of those tests to be taken a little bit later than normally. But it's just, you know, I would hate to be a teacher because it's just had to have bollocksed up your calendar. Yeah. And even if it's a 2-hour delay, you know, the shortened periods or whatever. And yeah, it's been a mess.
You wonder if it's, I mean, we're talking with a panel of reporters here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Right now we're talking about snow and snow days, or calamity days as they call them here in Ohio. Jackie, you just wonder if we're thinking too much. I mean, we have bad winters. This isn't even the worst winter we've had. I think we're like tied for second now or something like that. It's bad, but it's not, you know, historically terrible. Cities and towns have to buy more salt. when we have more snow. That costs more money. They have to pay plow drivers more money when there's more snow. They have to fix more potholes after a harsh winter. Shouldn't we just suck it up for this year, make the kids go to school an extra few days, pay the cost, and then pick it up next year? Is that too simple?
I think that the question is, if you're going to make up days into June, how many kids are you going to teach, and are those quality instruction days? I'm thinking back to when I was in school, and if you had an extra couple days tacked onto your year, which is what we did in Illinois at the time, those days were spent watching movies or coloring or playing outside. They were not spent on any sort of instruction that was helping us get ready for anything. I mean, it's the end of the year. There's no carrot. And that's a big issue. Plus, what these days do is they take the pressure off the superintendent to make any other decisions to cancel school in the coming weeks. I mean, we could it's what, March 3rd. Yep. We still have 4 or 5 weeks of winter left.
There's no more snow coming.
absolutely not.
I'll guarantee you there's no more snow coming.
But if there is snow, then the superintendent doesn't have to think, oh, if I cancel school, now we're going to have to go into June. It's a matter then of safety.
Yep.
Is it in the best interest of my students to get on that bus and come to school today?
Right. And one of the issues, too, is some of these makeup days might be after somebody's graduation.
Yeah.
And those are scheduled sometimes at the last weekend of May. And so those kids definitely aren't going to show up if they've matriculated already.
Oh, senior? Yeah. Senioritis is kicking in right about now, I think. You know? This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're speaking with a State House panel of reporters. We'll come back and we'll talk about John Kasich's plans for an income tax cut for folks here in the state of Ohio when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking what's in the news. Our reporters roundtable, Daryl Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch, Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press, and Jackie Borchard from the Northeast Ohio Media Group are joining us here. You can join the conversation, 292-8513. That's area code 614. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are still waiting for details from Governor Kasich on his plan to cut the state income tax. The governor says he wants to get the rate below 5% for everyone. It turns out only the top half, one half of 1% of earners, are actually taxed above that 5% level. John Kasich claims people are moving out of Ohio to lower tax states, and the state is losing a lot of money because of that. Democrats argue this tax cut plan only benefits the very wealthy and would hurt local communities. Jackie Borchard, the rate is now 5.33% now. So it would only take a cut of, 6.5% to get it below 5% for everybody.
Even less than that, 6.3. If we're talking decimals here, which we are, I mean, you're going from what most would consider to be, it's a pretty small gap already. But to be able to say under 5% is the message that the governor is going for. And so it's only a small percent of people that this affects. It's only a small percent it's going down. But the big statement they're looking for is to be able to say, well, we're under 5, which is, in the grand scheme of things, kind of an arbitrary number.
So this is largely symbolic, Daryl, would you say? He could go lower than that, though. He could lower by 10%,
right,
like he did last time.
The minimum, he wants to get that top rate under 5%. Symbolic, this is the world they say Ohio needs to be in because, neighboring states, their top rates for the large part are also under 5%. Of course, the big difference is their top rate goes into much lower income brackets than Ohio's does.
So we have the graduated income tax where a lot of states it's just flat.
Right.
So that also, Julie, that leads to the Democrats' argument that when you cut the income tax across the board in Ohio, because the lower folks are paying none or a much lower rate, this does really just benefit the top 1% or even 0.5%.
Right. I think I agree with Daryl. I'm not sure it's entirely symbolic because there was a gentleman who the governor took a lot of his numbers from in the speech. You stopped into Ohio last week, and who wrote a book called How Money Walks. It's fascinating stuff about the IRS data on migration and how people do move. I think the argument is whether they're moving for exclusively for tax purposes. That, you know, you do see people migrate from states with higher tax rates to states with lower ones, but a lot of those are in the South, where the weather's also nicer. There, we talked about how the there is a social element where if somebody starts to move to an area, a lot of people do. In our case, and in other northern states, they move to parts of Florida, for example, or Phoenix. But, you know, there is migration to areas with low taxes that are up in northern areas. So, you know, that's sort of the policy debate there.
Yeah, I mean, I know of one couple that they were retired. They had planned to move to Florida anyway, but they make sure that they are in Florida for 6 months and one day so they can get the lower or no tax. There's no income tax in
right.
Florida. So so in that case, I think they would have probably gone anyway, but the incentive to stay an extra month or so is there. And that's what the governor is talking. He says $12 billion over the last 19 years, which, you know, it comes out to about $600 million a year, which is, it's not small change, but it's really not a huge pot of money. That's economic money, not just tax money. So
right, and Florida doesn't have an income tax at all. Mm-hmm. I lived there for a little while, and, you know, they do try to make up with that with just a different tax structure. It doesn't make sense for them to have an income tax because the transient population. So they'll hit you with the property tax and the boat tax or the RV tax.
Don't they have a large sales tax, too, down there?
Right, because, so
tourism tax.
Yeah. Folks say it's for philosophical reasons, which it is, but it's not. It's just because it doesn't make sense for them.
So when do we expect to hear exactly what this tax cut will be?
Well, I mean, it should be in the midterm biennial review or budget review anytime now, maybe this week, next week. All these things that he mentioned in the speech will need to come together in some sort of equation, I would think.
Can the state pay for this tax cut right now without having to cut anything, without having to raise another tax someplace else, without having to raise the sales tax or cut local government further?
Well, sure, you could do it, I mean, on a temporary basis because, you know, with the recovery, things are really flush in Ohio. But that would be really interesting if they chose that because that's what they accuse the other side of. The details are going to be interesting. And we've seen this movie before to some extent, Mike, because the first budget of Governor Kasich, you know, proposed tax cuts, but he didn't say right then how he was going to cover those tax cuts. And it turned out to be raising the sales tax, broadening the sales tax, and a severance tax. Now there's talk, you go to the Society of Ohio CPAs website, I don't know if they have the inside scoop or they just have good speculation. They're talking about increasing the commercial activities tax. Again, the severance tax, most people are expecting that to be in this upcoming mid-biennium review budget
adjustment.
That's the
tax on drillers, natural gas and oil drillers, yep.
Right. So, you know, the last time, since the governor did not really bounce that off of, you know, what are called stakeholders in this crazy government business, they really fell flat. And you just wonder, is that going to happen again, or has he greased the skids and we're just not seeing it?
Well, and you look at the irony here. When you mention the Democrats' argument about income tax, personal income tax hitting the higher income brackets, the small business owners, and then you look at the irony of we would be raising direct business taxes on businesses. So the CAT tax is the commercial activity tax. You know, both Republicans and Democrats have supported that tax from its inception as an interesting sort of hybrid way to get away from taxing inventory and, yeah, and disincentivizing commerce, essentially. But it's had its problems. It's run into problems in the Supreme Court with the grocers saying you can't tax me and the cable guys saying you can't tax me. And so that one, and then the other business taxes would be an interesting way to go.
Let's go to the phones. Mark, you're on All Sides with Ann Fisher with a panel of State House reporters talking about the state budget. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes. My question is, how do states such as Texas and Florida that do not have a state income tax pay for the various services the states provide to their citizens? And I have my father-in-law lives in Cape Coral, just outside of Fort Myers. And on the property tax side, his taxes per thousand on the value of his house is significantly less than ours is here in Central Ohio. So I know there's different shifting components, but I'm wondering specifically, that's a lot of money that the states are foregoing on income tax. What specific components are they taxing in addition to provide those benefits?
Thanks.
If anybody knows that, I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, I mean, tourism is huge in Florida. I think that, you know, as I say, the way that they can structure their tax system there and their fees and their collections, they can funnel some of that economic development money toward government functions. And in Texas, I think they have a higher severance tax than we do. Oil and gas is huge there. So, you know, each state dovetails it to what their industry is and how much money is flowing in that way. I do recall also as a resident of Florida, you pay sort of a tax to live there versus they don't want to tax income because, as Mike says, a lot of people live there 6 months in a day and they're not stable forces in terms of collecting on their income because they're either retirees or part-year residents.
Well, there's one state that's actually done away with an income tax, and that's Alaska. And they've only been able to do so because they have a very high rate on oil and gas, and they have a lot of oil interest up there. If you look at states that have tried to cut back their income tax rates, the first place they go is the sales tax. And Texas, more than a quarter of their revenue comes from sales taxes. So they have a bigger base of people. They also, I believe, have a higher rate than we do in Ohio. So that seems to be where people go first. And the severance tax clearly is an option here. This would be the governor's third go at it.
Yeah.
Third year in a row.
It's been harder than getting the natural gas out of the shale, I think, to get that thing approved.
Really?
Try some like horizontal drilling to get the legislation to move.
There you go.
Right, and you have to dovetail your sales tax when you raise it to what your industry is. So, you know, in Florida, it might be RVs or boats or that kind of thing, as I mentioned. And, you know, in another state, it would be cigarettes or alcohol.
Arkansas has a 10% mixed drink tax.
Hmm. Well, there you go.
Do we want that in Ohio?
I wonder what the Alcoholic Beverage Association would think about that. And it goes, the reason why governors and politicians want to cut taxes is they say it spurs economic development. But Darryl, we have cut the income tax in Ohio, what, 20% over the past 6 years?
The first round of cuts took effect in 2005 under Governor Taft and the Republican legislature.
So we should be rolling in dough
21%,
right now.
Yeah. And Governor Kasich was 10%. Now we're proposing at least, you know, 6%. And there's been various other cuts as well. And that's the question I think this, to me, interests me just as a reporter covering this as an issue. You hear the Kasich administration talk so ardently about return on investment in terms of economic development. And okay, where's the return on investment of $1 billion in tax cuts over the last 9 years in Ohio? Is it there or isn't it? You know, I asked a lot of people that question last week, and you get a lot of ambiguous answers like, well, Reagan did it at work then, or it would have been even worse without it. Well, how do you ever establish that? You can say that about anything. You know, if Ohio State had worse football teams, it would have been a lot worse for the economy or what have you, you know?
Well, there's so many factors that go into a business choosing to stay or relocate. And there have been many studies showing that, you know, if you rank all the factors that these companies or businesses consider, income tax is not at the top. Things like education, infrastructure, which ironically are the things that your income tax revenue pays for. State government.
But one of the things this author that I spoke to last week was talking about is, you know, even if the business should choose to stay, the people can be leaving for the reason that the income tax is perceived as too high or as a hit to their bottom line or their family out-of-pocket spending. And so, you know, maybe they're moving away, even if their business chooses to stay.
And the argument is that by cutting the taxes in the first budget, the state cutting the income tax in the first budget, it raised the sales tax, of course, but also shifted the burden because they cut local governments. A lot of local school districts and local governments were forced to go to the voters and raise property taxes. Now, the voters had to approve that, but, you know, okay, you're paying less in income tax to the state, but now you're paying more in property taxes on your house.
Right. And that's subject of fierce debate. And just to give you an insight into a newsroom, we have tried to write very carefully about that first year that, you know, there were no tax increases by the state, because there is an argument, and whether you buy it or not, there certainly is an argument that can be made that did just get passed downhill. And, you know, we're going to hear a lot about that in this election year, and that, you know, the state, quote unquote, balanced its budget on the backs of local school districts and townships and counties and cities and villages.
292-8513. If you'd like to join our discussion, we're talking with a panel of State House reporters about what's in the news, especially what's coming up in the news this week. The tax cut debate is going to start to really heat up, especially as the governor's race heats up. 292-8513 or allsides@wosu.org is our email address. This tax cut, if it does come down as an across-the-board tax cut, whether it's 6.3% or 7%, it definitely will favor the top earners more, as far as a dollar-wise, bottom-line dollar figure goes, than it does lower-wage earners. And, Julie, does that not play right into Ed Fitzgerald's and the Democrats' hands saying that John Kasich is just looking out for the rich?
Well, I'm sure they'll make that argument, but the midterm budget will be complex, I think, and I think that it'll have a lot of offsetting. What we've seen is the Kasich administration, as it does propose to raise taxes, as it has over the years, it also tries to do cuts simultaneously so it can meet sort of the Grover Norquist, you know, anti-tax increase pledge.
Yeah.
By putting a package together. You know, to me, the interesting question is, why do we now think the severance tax is going to be more viable than it was in the last budget when it couldn't pass? And also, as Daryl says, you know, we have a state budget that is in place, that's balanced. How do we figure out how to pay for this and get a bunch of lawmakers that have to run for election this year to dig into that kind of a quagmire?
Yeah. I mean, Jackie, passing any kind of tax increase, especially, I mean, if they haven't been able to pass the tax on drillers in a non-election year, are they really going to be able to pass a tax on drillers in an even number year when many of these lawmakers are up for election?
Well, the lawmakers have had 2 years now to kind of mull it over and get their emotional, you know, feeling rating on this issue, where some, I think, were immediately opposed to the idea 2 years ago, maybe now have warmed up to the idea. And if you tie this tax hike on drillers, if you tie it to something where if you balance the scales, it affects more people or hits more people like an income tax cut, then, you know, if you're weighing things, then that's a risk that may be worth taking.
292-8513. We're talking taxes right now with a panel of State House reporters here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Mark in Columbus, you have a novel idea for shifting the tax burden.
Yeah, it may seem novel, but actually it's something which others have developed in maybe a lot more detail than I'm aware of. Right now in Ohio, primarily more on the local level, we have property taxes, which you had all mentioned earlier, where you pay a tax based on the value of your property. In some parts of the U.S., they have what they call a land tax, where you're taxed based on the area of your property, but not on the value. The reason I'm asking it, in many of the areas, particularly in Columbus, that are trying to redevelop and rehabilitate and become nice areas that have gone downhill, there's a perverse incentive for some residents and landlords to keep their properties in horrible condition with the idea that they can lower their, if they keep the area a bad area, they can keep their property taxes lower, and it takes away the incentive for communities to upgrade themselves. And wondered if you had a thought on that. And also, if the question of impeachment should come up in regard to the presidency, how you, they, your reporters think that maybe the Ohio delegation's Republicans or Democrats might react to that.
All right, we'll pass on impeachment because I don't think that's likely occurrence right now. But on the issue of taxing land differently than we do now, it's based on value. Of course, if you have more land, you pay more taxes because the parcel is more valuable. But what about this idea of taxing land based on size rather than value?
Frank, I'd never heard of anything like that. There's hundreds of proposals out there for generating government revenue. Of course, pooling tax revenue, was one that's, I don't know, that seemed to be back under the Voinovich administration, perhaps, when we're talking more about the equity among school districts, but just almost pooling on a statewide level. To get at the disparities, I don't know if that's what the caller was sort of getting at or not. But you have a bottom line that government needs, and in theory we are the government, so we are determining that bottom line. So it's, how do you get that? Yeah. Somebody's ox has got to be gored to pay for it. Of course, nobody wants it to be me. We want it to be you and you and you. So let's fight
tax,
over it.
Don't tax you. Don't tax me. Tax the guy behind
the tree.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, Mayor Coleman used the property tax incentive to boost downtown housing. I mean, basically you had free property taxes, no property taxes for 10 years when this plan was instituted. And that allowed developers, condo developers, to build downtown and lower the monthly payments for the folks who bought down there. So the cities have used this for development in the past. Whether it would work in a place like Franklinton or other tough neighborhoods, I don't know. But
it sounds like something that would work better if it were targeted to certain areas. Just thinking, you know, it might be a wash to do it countywide or citywide, because you are going to have some higher value properties that may pay lower, but you also may have them pay higher because they sit on a big lot. But I think the targeted programs have been effective. I know quite a few people who got in to a tax abatement program in like Old Town East and that area just east of downtown. And that was a big plus for them. And it freed up some money right away that they could then use to improve the property.
Well, and for the state to get involved in that is pretty careful walk they'd have to make, because as Jackie says, I mean, if you are going to target it, who do you pick? Who do you not pick?
Yeah.
And if you're not going to target it, so I have a big piece of land and it is worth a lot, and you're lifting my, and now you're taxing me not on the value of my property when I'm a millionaire. Then so that becomes something that I wouldn't really envy the politician who has to decide it.
If you ever figure out a way to handle taxes that everyone was happy with, other than say you don't have to pay them, that person would be, talk about a Nobel Prize for economics or something like that. That'd be that. That's the holy grail there. We're talking about state politics, what's in the news this week. When we come back, we'll talk about voting hour changes and the controversy that has stirred up. We'll look at Gordon Gee's possible new job when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about what's in the news with a panel of reporters, Darrell Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch, Julie Carr Smythe from the Associated Press, and Jackie Borchard from the Northeast Ohio Media Group, who's also appears in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. They're with us this morning. Voting restrictions is back in the news. Imagine that. How, where, and when you can vote in the 2014 election is now set. Now, there is a chance of a lawsuit, but as of right now, Secretary of State John Husted has set uniform voting hours across the state. No matter what county you're in, early voting starts 29 days before the election. In-person voting will take place weekdays during business hours. The last two Saturdays before the election, you can also vote early in person. There is no evening in-person voting and no Sunday in-person voting. And Darrell Rowland, the Sunday voting is what's got Democrats upset, the lack of Sunday voting.
Well, actually, I think it's all,
yep,
all of it. I mean, they eliminated the so-called Golden Week. That whacks 6 days of early voting right there. Right. The late hours, the weekend hours, aside from the Saturday that you mentioned. And litigation, I think, is virtually certain on this. And it's interesting, the two sides, the one side looking to rein in the hours, if you will, can point with justification to the Ohio Association of Elections Officials, a bipartisan group. This is their recommendation to rein it in, eliminate Golden Week. Again, Golden Week is when you can register and vote, essentially, in, you know, one-stop shopping. The other side says, you know, we're not just creating this system from scratch now. You have several years of a track record. You know that minorities disproportionately use the current early voting system for those after hours, for Saturdays, for Sundays, what have you. So to rein that back in is inherently a racist move. It'd be an interesting debate for a judge to decide.
Practically, I mean, elections, this all began in 2004 when we had the really long lines in the Bush-Kerry presidential election year. They started no-fault absentee voting. You didn't have to have a reason to vote early. There was early in-person voting. The last few elections have gone very smoothly, virtually no cases of fraud. Why are we changing the rules?
Well, if you talk to Secretary Husted, yeah, he will say that it's important that we have a uniform system. He will stick to that talking point no matter how many questions you ask him.
Yep.
And, you know, I think he is a believer that that is the best way to eliminate questions about it. Of course, the Democrats disagree with that. Their strongholds are in heavily populated urban areas where many had expanded hours, expanded polling locations because of the fact that they were coping with large amounts of people. And so you can say, well, uniform across the state is entirely fair and the same for everyone, and it keeps elections fair. But the Democrats' argument is that we, in certain parts of Ohio, were expanding access to deal with heavy populations.
Democrats say it's harder to vote than ever. It's getting harder and harder to vote. Yes, we lost a week. We've lost some Sunday voting, Jackie Borchard, but we still have 29 days of early voting. You still can vote by mail from home if you want. How hard is it really that hard to vote in Ohio?
Well, Ohio's voting rules now, the way they stand and how they're going to be for the rest of the year, still put us near the top of states. There was a presidential commission looking at voting rights across the states, and Ohio was looked favorably upon in that report and for doing a lot of things right, for cutting back on those lines, for being efficient, mailing out absentee ballot requests, for example. Everyone's going to get one of those again this year from Secretary Husted. So it is easy to vote, but any way you slice it, there's still fewer days to go vote in person this year than there was in 2012.
And what we're sort of talking about was this phenomenon of, you know, the Obama campaign would say, register someone, take them on a Sunday to the polls, and so they could register and busload people to the polls on a Sunday, which is a big day for everybody to go to church, but yeah, certainly for African-American populations, they were targeting those areas, taking those folks, registering them. So it was rather masterful on their part how they made it work. And that's really what we're talking about.
So, Daryl, is that the argument against Sunday voting? Is that Sunday voting, it might be convenient for some, but it's largely been used as an organization effort. You have your souls to the polls, and it's a way for Democrats, you know, largely African-American churches for the most part, to get people to the polls. Is that why we should be setting voting hours? Because of campaign organizations?
Well,
kind of a chicken and egg thing, I guess.
Well, exactly. Now, you will hear, especially from smaller counties where this is not quite the phenomenon it is in Cuyahoga and Franklin and Hamilton, the big counties, that, hey, this is cost. We have small budgets. We're scraping by. to pay our workers to stay open for what may be just a handful of voters on that Sunday, that hurts us. But make no mistake about this whole debate. It is about who they want to show up and cast a vote. And Democrats want more, Republicans want fewer, generally speaking, because I win when my turnout scenario happens. I win more often, I'll put it that way. So that's what this is about. It's just pretty much raw, naked politics. You can put the good government veneer on some of it, but bottom line, that's what the argument is about.
And the reason when Darrell says that the Republicans want fewer, it's because you Republicans are more loyal, more likely to vote in a lot of different scenarios, say during the workday, when it's raining, whatever. And so when there's fewer, the percentage of Republicans goes up.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. And as Darrell said, the prospects of a court challenge are very real, and it likely will happen sometime between now and November. Other topics in the news this week, that the city of Columbus has gone full out looking for one of the two Republican or Democrat national conventions in 2016. The official deadline for a Republican application was last week, and Columbus is among half dozen or eight finalist cities there. They had a big party, big shindig for the Democratic National Committee last week in Washington, D.C. What are the odds? If you had to put money on the table right now, what are the odds that Columbus lands one of these two conventions?
Well, I think the odds went up that Ohio would land one by the fact that Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati all were accepted as finalists.
For the Republican convention.
For the Republican convention. But I don't think on the Republican side that any of those cities are necessarily at the top of the list.
People say Vegas is I've heard somebody say it was the logical choice, which is kind of ironic that Sin City is the logical choice for a political convention, but that's okay.
Who could argue? sure, the odds are against us. And, we tried this before in 06 and leading up to the 2008 conventions. And Mayor Coleman and the group then realized we just didn't have the hotel capacity. As far as I got, that proposal had people staying at Chillicothe in Mansfield.
Yeah.
On the other hand, my team that went to Charlotte, they were housing people almost to South Carolina. Those of us who went down to Tampa for the Republican National Convention, it was a great hotel, but it was like right by the airport and the bus system was a mess. It's like, can Columbus really do any worse than that?
There's a slogan. Well, we can't do any worse than Tampa.
It's held up like it's this big, huge standard. And, of course, if you have a New York City or an L.A., it's like it's just another happening.
Yeah.
But once you get out of those top handful of metro areas, it is the major event in town. It changes life for everyone within the town, requires a multi-million dollar effort. Security, transportation, and just the logistics are, daunting.
How about this rivalry I don't know if it's a rivalry, but, Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus, as Julie mentioned, are all finalists for the Republican convention. They all want the Democratic convention. And Brent Larkin wrote in the Plain Dealer over the weekend, he wrote all the reasons why Cleveland's a better choice than Columbus. He said, Columbus is a fine town, but Cleveland has more to offer. And he said, if Cleveland loses to Columbus, it would be, quote, humiliating and inexcusable. Jackie Borchardt does a fight in words.
Ouch. Yeah. Yeah, I'm torn because...
You're a colleague of yours.
I know. And I love Cleveland and I love Columbus, too. And I think it's a win for Ohio if any of these cities gets the conventions. We're a very diverse state. You have Cleveland in a Democratic stronghold. You have Cincinnati, which, Hamilton County has gone Democratic, but Southwest Ohio is a largely Republican-leaning part of the state. Columbus, you've got a Democratic city with Republican outlying counties. I think a convention from either party in any city would be fascinating and it would be good for Ohio in general. But I have to say, I do hope Columbus gets it. And I think that I think just thinking about the convention festivities in downtown Columbus, I can see it working. I can see people being bused to hotels at Polaris and in Dublin. And to me, that's not any further than where they bus people from Denver or in Minneapolis-St. Paul. So I think it can work. I think all three cities could host it and host a good convention.
The problem is, I mean, there are 19,000 hotel rooms within the Outer Belt. City leaders say there are about 4,000 or 5,000 downtown, right near the arena, the Nationwide Arena, where it would be held. So hotels seems to be okay. It's the direct flights. 30 cities are served by direct flights by Port Columbus, and most of those are east of the Mississippi. West, when you fly west, there's a few direct flights, you know, to L.A. and Denver and Texas, but it's tough. Getting here is tough.
Well, Cleveland was just hurting that because, hey, they're losing a hub. So an advantage that Cleveland did have over Columbus, I think, has just gone away. Mm-hmm. But you're right. That's one of the obstacles. Columbus has no rail like Cleveland does. So that's a plus for Cleveland. Cleveland has, I was up, and as was Julie, up to hear Ed Fitzgerald give his State of the County speech in their brand new convention center, mm-hmm. which I must say is impressive. Very gleaming. They're starting a new hotel. I have no idea if it'd be up in time, but the largest hotel ever started in Cuyahoga County. So
they do say it will be ready for 2016.
Okay.
And that convention center there is massive.
Is it near the arena? I don't even know where it is.
It's right next to Public Auditorium.
Okay.
The old Public Hall, which has hosted a couple of conventions. So it's in that downtown area, but, it would be a little bit of a longer walk to get to the Q,
yeah.
or the casino,
not, right.
you know, like or Brown Stadium is right there.
Well, that's right. Columbus doesn't have a casino downtown to
that's
entertain
true.
Us.
Yes.
Come back
to bite them.
I think the buses would run.
The thing,
I guarantee it.
The thing about Brent's argument, I can see that, Cleveland's idea is we have major league sports. We have world-class symphony. We are, sort of this city on the lake with the rail and the mm-hmm. big city kind
Rock
of feel.
Roll Hall of Fame.
And
the
right. Yeah. But Columbus has never had a convention. I did a little bit of historical research, and Cincinnati had a couple way back in the 1800s, 1850s or so, and Cleveland has also had a couple conventions, but Columbus has never really had its term, which might play into its favor.
It could also play that this is the new city in Ohio as opposed to the Rust Belt or the city in Cincinnati. One person is leaving Ohio. It's official. The West Virginia University Board of Governors has voted unanimously to welcome Gordon Gee as president of the school for a full term today. Is anyone surprised that he took the job permanently? I mean, here's how this went. He was named interim president, but suddenly that title changed where he was named president of the university on an interim basis. Now that interim's gone. He's leaving to go to West Virginia. Anyone surprised?
I wasn't too surprised. He's just a bundle of energy, not mentioning sort of why he had to leave Ohio State, which it seems like nobody really asked him about, but he certainly didn't seem like he was at a retirement age to me. I think that the appointment that he got from Governor Kasich to work on higher ed issues and the economy was probably just a...
That was interim.
Yes, that was interim, yes. And that was probably just a stopgap until he could figure out what he was going to do to, provide him a fallback.
Bow ties in Morgantown.
That's right.
And, he's in almost heaven now, right? Yeah. I guess he was in heaven before, so maybe it's a step down.
Well, he's going, it's funny, it's like, this is your life in reverse. He was at Ohio State, right. Left, came back, he started his career in West Virginia University, and now he's come back. And, I mean, that's a school, it's a state that's had its economic troubles, and Jackie Borchardt, somebody like that could really breathe some new life into West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. And like Julie said, he's a little bundle of energy that, it's infectious when people meet him, his smile, the bow tie, the quirky personality, it injects some life. And that's why OSU brought him back here. And that's why I'm sure West Virginia asked him to stay.
But it does sort of play up a bit of the hypocrisy in the whole departure where, you say, I've had a long vacation and I've decided I need to spend more time with my family. And, within this very short time, you're right back at a different position.
Yeah, I mean, he's a young acting person, but he's 70 years old.
Yeah, well, and Jim Tressel could just be north a little ways in Youngstown State. How about that?
I know one person who's, you lose some fundraising prowess when Gordon Gee leaves town, but Michael Drake has to be kind of quietly relieved that there's no shadow of Gordon Gee as he prepares to take over the presidency of Ohio State University. Jackie Borchardt from the Northeast Media Group, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press and Darrell Rowland from the Columbus Dispatch.
Thanks, Mike.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, and online at WOSU.org.